this evening, the presentations, the conversations being taped and will be aired on the radio, and we'll give the people all the information about where that will be. And we've done this before here on the shore in different places. It's our first time doing it here in this part of Virginia. And so I'm very happy to be here. And this will be on our program called the Mark Steiner Show, which most of you can get on the net. Our signal where we broadcast from doesn't get here. But let me introduce a panel to you. And each panel member is going to give a presentation, short one. And then we start a conversation, and we want you to be part of the conversation. And I will grab this mic and come out here as far as this cord will let me go to meet you out there so you can ask questions, give your thoughts, enter the discussion and debate, and put it out there, because I think this is something that communities across the shore are discussing. And I think in many ways, Accomack and Northampton are in a very unique position in terms of where things are now to really talk about what the future can be. So this is really a good place to have this. Let me introduce the folks with me. See, next to me is Carol Morrison, who for years was a poultry grower, a contract farmer with Purdue. She now has her own company that raises eggs out of Pocomoke City. And next to her is Dr. J.M. Fry from the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. And next to her is Mark Brush, Associate Professor of Marine Science at VIMS. And next to him is Maria Payan, who is a consultant with Social Responsible Animal Project. And then next to him is Neil Zardakov, who is the Virginia DEQ Manager, Office of Land Applications. And next to him, Roger Everton, who is also the same place, but Manager of Water Quality Compliance and Monitoring. So we're going to start with the folks from DEQ. And I think, Neil, you're going to go first. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And then we'll introduce the others and present. Think about what they're saying. We really want you to kind of, this is really interactive. It's a community meeting. We want people to have their thoughts heard. So go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to present to you a lot of information in a very short period of time. I'm hoping that anything that I roll over too quickly for you, we can handle in the question and answer session. But what I wanted to do, first of all, is just give you an overall glimpse at what is regulated, because that's, we certainly want to base discussion around facts about what is and isn't. So as far as what I'll, like I said, a lot of information, but a little bit about the way DEQ is structured, what state agencies are involved in regulation, some of the requirements for specific requirements, a little bit about what we do with operations that don't require permits, as well as what we're doing for the Chesapeake Bay total maximum daily load and the watershed implementation plan. So first of all, just quickly about DEQ, we're divided into three divisions, water, air, and land protection. And the regulation for confined poultry is in the water division. So if there were somebody that were managing a landfill or disposal of waste, that would be in a separate division and at DEQ. So as far as water regulations are concerned, we primarily look at two different components, point sources and non-point sources. Point sources are where there is a flow of pollutants to a water body. Non-point sources are the way we regulate confined poultry, and that's where there is non-point source pollution, whether it be from land application or activities that might go on with storage or management of manure. As far as state agencies that are involved in regulation, DEQ manages discharges from point sources as well as permitted non-point sources. The Department of Conservation and Recreation is our sister agency, and they administer the Nutrient Management Planning Program, which determines what the content and the technical requirements for managing nitrogen and phosphorus. The Department of Agriculture in Virginia has an Ag Stewardship Program, which is designed to address complaints at non-permitted operations. So, DEQ has been regulating agriculture for a long time, began in the 70s when there were some issues with shellfish waters and livestock. We first had individual permits for livestock and poultry operations in the 80s. In the 1990s, a general permit was developed for livestock, and in Virginia that's defined as the hooved animals, basically. And then in 2000, the General Assembly said, yep, you also need to regulate dry poultry manure as well. And so they fell under mandatory requirements for permits. In 2004, our point source program expanded a bit for concentrated animal feeding operations. And then in 2010, from observations that a lot of poultry manure was being transferred off the permitted farm, that there are now end-user regulations in place since 2010 for the folks that receive transferred manure. So in Virginia, the general permit for poultry is required if there are more than 20,000 chickens or 11,000 turkeys confined, and we define confinement as being held in a space with no vegetation for 45 or more days of the year, and those aren't necessarily consecutive days. There are approximately 900 general permits for poultry operations in Virginia, and that covers about 85% of confined poultry operations. So most poultry operations in Virginia meet those minimum thresholds for sizes to require a permit. The Virginia Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, those point source discharge permits, is something that we don't have anywhere near enough time here tonight to talk about what EPA has done with that program. All I can say is that in Virginia, we've been regulating poultry for a long, long time. And under our VPA program, we do have a few permits that are converting to the CAFO permits, but there are some different size thresholds, but it basically... To require a VPTES permit, it's required when there is an actual discharge to surface waters. So as far as what the permits require in Virginia, proper storage, which essentially amounts to making sure that if it's stored for longer than 14 days, that it's covered and that there's something underneath to protect groundwater. The nutrient management plan is a critical component of the permit. Involving analysis of soil, analysis of the litter, so you know what nutrients are there and what nutrients are being supplied by land-applied poultry litter. Timing and rate, of course, critical components. Setbacks from environmental features as well as homes. Record-keeping requirements for what's been put where, as well as requirements for mortality disposal. For those who receive transferred litter from confined poultry operations, there are requirements for storage. Application timing are all exactly the same as that for a permitted grower. As far as application rate, for a permitted grower, they're required to have a nutrient management plan that has been approved by the Department of Conservation and Recreation. For a person that receives transferred litter, they don't necessarily have to have that approved plan. They have four options, and NMP is one of them. And the other three options are all more conservative as far as a phosphorus application rate would be concerned. They have setback requirements that are the same, some record-keeping requirements, and they could be required to get a permit if they're not compliant with the general rules, but we have not permitted any end users of litter at this point. As far as operations that do not meet the permitting threshold, like I said, about 85% of the poultry operations in Virginia do, but there are a few that there are 137 operations in the Chesapeake Bay watershed that fall below that permitting threshold. The Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Agriculture came up with a strategy to look at those operations that would support the efforts by EPA to make sure that these operations weren't discharging, as well as to make sure that we were meeting our Chesapeake Bay goals. It's a proactive strategy to make sure that discharges aren't occurring, that there aren't direct discharges of pollutants to surface waters. And so there were 649 small dairies that we identified in Virginia, as well as those 137 poultry operations. The operators participate in this program voluntarily, and then have, if issues are detected, there are four options to correct those. up to and including the requirement for DEQ permits. Between 2012 and today's date, we've completed over 1,000 evaluations of operations in Virginia, and we've used voluntary implementation to correct those issues that we found in all those cases. We had not required permits of any of those smaller operations. But then the last thing I wanted to just touch on is the Bay TMDL and the Watershed Implementation Plan. That includes a suite of voluntary as well as mandatory programs. The permitted aspect is part of it. With poultry, most of the requirements are mandatory. There isn't with dairy, there's a whole suite of other things. Stream exclusion, for example, that is not mandatory across the state. So that plays more of a role voluntarily. DCR also has a resource management plan program for farmers to voluntarily implement best management practices. And DEQ, I make this statement to any audience that whether you're a proponent of more permits or a proponent of more voluntary practices, when we're implementing program, we've seen things work well both voluntarily and in permitted aspects. And so where there are things currently being done voluntarily and they work, we support that approach as well. So that's, like I said, a real quick lightning-fast view of the regulation in Virginia for poultry. And so I don't know if we're taking questions now. If we're going to hold
Roger. No, we're going to go through the panel first. So Roger Everton, go ahead.
Good evening. I'm Roger Everton. I am the Water Compliance and Monitoring Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality out of the Tidewater Regional Office. And I'm going to change gears a little bit and talk about our water quality monitoring and assessment programs and how we use that information in our assessments to look at water quality and see where we need to make improvements. Doesn't show up quite correctly, but it should be a center wheel. This figure depicts what we call the water wheel at DEQ, and it shows how our programs are interrelated on the water side. They all rotate around our water quality standards. Our water quality standards are numerical and narrative descriptions of what the water quality should be. So we have numbers that say this is the level necessary to be protective, or a description that tells us this is what the water quality should look like. We have a program. We go out and we monitor. We collect a lot of data. We take that data, feed it into our assessment where we're looking at what the data is versus the standards and versus a variety of different uses that water can be, such as shellfish harvest or recreation. We take that data and we assemble it and we put it into several reports where we're describing the conditions, and we also are listing or identifying waters that are impaired for some specific use. Once we do that and the water's impaired, then we move on to develop what's called total maximum daily loads, TMDLs, and I'll talk about those a little bit more. And then we use that information to move through to develop corrective action plans or implementation plans, and the whole system feeds back into that continuous monitoring to determine if our actions have been successful and we are now meeting water quality standards. Our water quality monitoring program has a number of elements with a number of objectives. There are different type of programs, all associated with water quality monitoring, but they have, again, different objectives, and we conduct that monitoring in different ways. Our primary program is what we call our ambient water quality monitoring, where we go out to stations on a routine basis, monthly or every other month, and collect water and test that water for a variety of different constituents. We have some stations that we call trend stations that we've been going to that same station, that same spot for many years, 20 years or more, that allows us to look at that data in a different way than if we're just looking at the current status of the water. We also do lakes monitoring. We do incident response. If we have a problem, something happened, we are able to mobilize and go out and collect water samples. We do special studies to address specific issues that come up. DEQ is heavily involved in the Chesapeake Bay program and those monitoring aspects. And if you'll notice, there's a couple terms on there that say probabilistic monitoring. That's the type of monitoring where instead of a human selecting the station, a computer randomly selects that station without bias, and we go to that station, and we can use that data in a specific way to analyze water quality conditions throughout a region. This figure depicts stations that we monitored on the Eastern Shore over a certain period of time. This was about a five-year period of time. Different places where we collected stations under those different programs. If you notice, we have fairly wide coverage throughout the shore. If you'll see, and there are different programs. If you'll notice the string of dots offshore, that was a special study we did in cooperation with NOAA to look at our nearshore water quality data. The green dots, if that shows up, that's our primarily monitoring program where we are able to sample on a routine basis. So what do we do when we out collect a sample? We do typical things, which we call the field measurements. When we're on site, we look at temperature, conductivity, or salinity. We look at the pH of the water. And then we collect samples and send them back to the lab for analysis. That typically involves looking at bacterial, whether it be E. coli, fecal coliform, or enterococcus. We also do chlorophyll in our estuarine waters. We look at nitrogen and phosphorus, which are important indicators for us, as well as the solids of what I would call turbidity or clarity in the water column. If you can see the stations that are in purple, those are probabilistic stations. Those stations are where we do the more extensive or the more complex testing, where we're actually looking at sediment chemistry, toxicity, and that type work. Once we have that data, we, on a regular basis, we assess the data that we've been collecting. And we collect that data and we look at it based on specific, what we call designated uses. And those uses are things like aquatic life. Is the water quality meeting the needs for the aquatic organisms in the stream or river? Fish consumption. Is there toxics in fish tissue that would deem we have to do an advisory? Shellfish consumption. The Department of Health has an extensive monitoring program within their agency where they collect bacteria data throughout the streams. We don't reanalyze or reassess their data, but we use their assessments of shellfish growing areas as part of our overall assessment that we do. We also look at swimming and recreation standards, public supply, water supply, and also wildlife use. So on a regular basis, again, we're taking that data and say, are our waters meeting those uses or not?
How regular?
Wait just a second. So we can move to the table. Go ahead.
We have to write all these questions down
and then. Yes. All these programs have different frequencies. Many of the stations we do on a monthly or every other month basis. The probabilistic stations, by design, they are done one time and then we go to another station. Some stations are seasonal, so they vary based on the objectives of the monitoring program. Yes, and I'll get to that in just a second.
So let me just jump in for a minute. So we have like four, these other panels have to get through. So we're trying to make these as short as possible, 5-10 minutes, so we can get through everybody. Then we can talk about, I mean, hold your questions. We'll get to all these questions. Because what you just raised a moment ago was important. So it needs to be dealt with. So we have to, but I want to let people get through this as quickly as we can.
If you look at our water quality data throughout the state, by far, our biggest problem in terms of impairment of our water quality is bacteria impairments. Much less so, we see problems with our dissolved oxygen levels, are benthic organisms, and those are the organisms that live in the bottom of the stream. They're affected by poor water quality, pH problems. And then the mercury and the PCB, that's actually a reflection of contaminants that we see in fish tissue, and the health department has deemed that certain areas of the state that they issue fish consumption advisories based on the level of those contaminants in fish tissue. I'm not sure you can see it from here real well, but on the screen. But as I indicated, since we do long-term monitor stations, where we've been at stations for up to 30 years at the same station on a regular basis, it allows us to actually look at trends. So we do status and trends. The trends, we use a statistical program, and it gives an indication of whether things are getting better or worse over time. And this one is one for bacteria, a trend in bacteria. And fortunately, most of the state is showing a positive trend in the in bacteria. In other words, things are getting better in terms of bacterial contamination. We also take that data, and part of that assessment is to identify and list those impaired waters. This is just a depiction of the type of information we'll put out in our reports showing waterways that have some type of impairment. Again, our impairments, we're looking at parameter by parameter. So if you look where there's red, there's some type of impairment within that stream. And there may be different impairments. Some of this is an overlap with the Chesapeake Bay TMDL issues. Some of it may be a bacteria issue. Some of it may be a DO issue. And you can actually drill down in all these segments. They're subdivided to determine what that impairment might be.
And Roger, excuse me.
Yeah.
Just want to kind of get as fast through this as you can, because
yes.
we've already done a half an hour through. We've got to get other people
Sorry.
Up here so the audience can come in.
Hey. Again, this information is available. If you go to the DEQ website and you search for water quality assessment, it will take you to page, and both our 2012 report and our 2014 report are on there. All the information is contained in our website. What do we do once we do our assessment? We have that list of waters that are impaired. Then we go to what we call a total maximum daily load assessment, where we look at all these streams and we determine what level of pollutant, whether it be a bacteria or some other pollutant, that stream can assimilate and still meet our water quality standards. You've probably heard the term pollution diet. I like to think it more of a parameter-specific amount of material that can enter that water and still meet all those designated uses we were talking about. This figure is a depiction of where we have completed TMDLs on the Eastern Shore. As you can see, we've been doing a lot of work over the last 10 to 12 years on developing these TMDLs. When we do a TMDL, we're looking at the whole watershed, not just the impaired water segment. So we're looking at the land use and all those other items that may contribute to that impairment. We work with our institutions and consultants to do extensive and fairly complex modeling to determine what type of reductions we have to do to meet that water quality in that stream. And again, all that information is available on our website. As you see here, this is, you can drill down, do a search for a specific water body, and see our TMDL reports. And finally, once we've done a TMDL report, we can move on to creating TMDL implementation plans. And this is where we ask you as citizens, stakeholders, along with our other conservation partners, to come in and develop a plan where we're going to try to develop a set of goals and a set of objectives and action plans to put on the ground to get our waters back to meeting the designated uses.
Let's turn here to Mark Brush.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I have a few slides. for kind of informational purposes as to what we've been doing in my lab over the past few years in terms of research here on the Eastern Shore, specifically related to models. And Roger just finished by mentioning models used to inform TMDLs. And this is a similar sort of ecosystem modeling approach that we employ. And what I'm going to talk about are specifically two efforts we've done. One, to develop a computer model to predict nitrogen loads coming off of your watersheds here on the shore, on the seaside. And then a second model looking at, well, once that nitrogen is in your coastal bays, or I'll call them lagoons probably through this talk, what's the impact on things like water quality and habitat? And this I need to acknowledge Sea Grant as being a huge benefactor of this work, both in Virginia but also in Maryland and Delaware. So I'm just going to give you a brief overview of what we've done and the capabilities are as they relate to the poultry issue. Again, we wanting to develop this watershed and estuarine or lagoon modeling capability so we can look at the effects of land use change and human activities such as poultry. And so what we're doing, as you'll see in a minute, in the watershed is we take a given watershed, for example, where the watershed that drains into Hog Island Bay. We've done it for all of the watersheds along the seaside from Cape Charles up through Rehoboth Bay in Delaware. And we'll specify things like land use, crop. The pointer's working, isn't it? The crops, and you'll see this in more detail in a minute, people, septic tanks in the watershed. But then germane to today is poultry houses. We've digitized all the poultry houses on the shore, and so we have estimates of the number of birds and so on. That feeds into a simple spreadsheet model, which spits out the amount of nitrogen entering the receiving lagoon. We care about nitrogen especially because that tends to be what controls water quality in these systems. We do calculate phosphorus load as well, but nitrogen is the big point of our work. And then the second model is animated, and the second model then turns that nitrogen load into some of these water quality response metrics Roger was just talking about, chlorophyll in the water, nutrient concentrations, as well as accumulations of macroalgae, potential for seagrass to survive and what have you. Just to show you how we do it, kind of get under the hood of what's going on in these calculations before I show you some very quick results. On the watershed side, again, for every watershed along the seaside, what we've done is to specify land use, and we calculate the amount of nitrogen that rains down onto the land. There's nitrogen both coming in the rain and coming in particles settling out. We know crop rotations, both row crops and the tomato plasticulture you have, and so we specify crop rotations and acreage in different land use or agricultural categories and specify fertilizer application rates. And then here for today, we have the poultry operations. There's a lot of uncertainty in those calculations because first of all, we know pretty well the number of the density of birds in each house and how much nitrogen a typical bird will produce in a year. What we don't know as well is how much of that waste volatilizes or how much is contained by concrete pads, how much washes off. So there's some uncertainty in those calculations, but we're nonetheless able to bracket a reasonable value for nitrogen coming out of those houses. And then we do include septic tanks and point sources. And all of that nitrogen that's deposited to the land surface, the model then processes as it moves through the groundwater and ultimately into the coastal bay or the lagoon downstream. What the model does in the lagoon is to take those inputs we just talked about, and based on first principles in biological marine science, we can predict the response of the phytoplankton, the algae, the single-celled algae that grow in the water and bloom. As they bloom, they tend to shade out the bottom, the benthic producers, photosynthesizers like macroalgae and seagrasses. So we're predicting how these guys respond as well. And we're predicting things like nutrient cycling, in-water concentrations of nitrogen, phosphorus, dissolved oxygen we can do. It's not operational in this model, but we do it a lot. So how they drive our work. We've done this model here on the Delmarva for all of the watersheds from Cape Charles, so Smith Island and South Bays on the southern tip, up through Rehoboth Bay. So it's a three-state. Every seaside watershed has been digitized, and we have loads being predicted and a copy of the lagoon model running. What I want to just show you is what we've done. Really lately, we've just been expanding the model. What we've done in the past with it is working more in Accomack in their comprehensive plan back in 2008, and we did some scenarios where we ran that watershed model and increased the number of poultry in the watershed. So, you know, various increases in the number of birds. And so we're capable. Now, this is going to be watershed specific, and so, you know, this is nothing we want to take as absolute truth for any watershed. But just you do see that as the watersheds are fairly sensitive. You increase the number of poultry and you get a fairly predictable increase. It's linear in the amount of nitrogen leaching out. There's a threshold. You have to, you know, down here you don't see anything because the assumption in the model, at least, and you can play with this, but the assumption is that any poultry waste is put on the crops to support fertilizer need. We can play with that. We can change that. But just as a first approximation, we are able to predict how the loads will respond to changes in poultry. And then what about water quality in these lagoons? Let's just focus over on the right. What I'm doing here is taking a typical coastal bay here. This is Hog Island Bay, and I've run the model with increasing amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus loading coming in. So from down here at one, the current load, one times, five times the current load, 10 times, and that seems like a big increase, but these watersheds are so small that it really doesn't take a lot to increase the loads that much. And what you see is these watershed, or these lagoons you have, are indeed quite sensitive to these nutrients. You see, it doesn't take too much nitrogen increase to really ramp up this is the phytoplankton, the algae in the water, the chlorophyll that would tend to shade out the benthos. The other thing that we see, are big increases in the macroalgae, or those seaweeds, the noxious seaweeds that grow and bloom all over these bays in the summer. So the indications from the model is the sensitivity to poultry does increase the nitrogen load, and these lagoons are quite nutrient sensitive. And we can get into all the details, but that's the quick overview.
Thank you so much, Roger. Let's go to Maria Payan.
Hi, I am Maria Payan. I work as a consultant, an independent consultant, for a nonprofit, which is national, called Socially Responsible Agricultural Project. We actually work with communities that reach out and call upon us as they are being impacted either by industrial animal production in the forms of permits for poultry houses, could be processing plants, could be manure to energy, anything that involves that field. I can tell you that I am, just like you, had our own business and moved from rural Pennsylvania to another part of Pennsylvania, which was very agricultural. Grew up around farms, totally understood farms. And we actually wanted to raise our child in a way that would be in a rural area where he could enjoy just that kind of a life, the nature, the beauty. The farm animals. There was cows on pasture, horses in a field behind us, and my son tried to teach Molly for years how to give me Paul the horse. Had to explain that horses don't give paws, only dogs do. And life was wonderful, and then they sold the farm. And an absentee landlord bought the property and started building a chicken house one at a time. And by the time they were done, we now lived across the street where we used to see animals out on pasture. There were long barns, longer than football fields, four of them, and 25,000 birds, broilers, in each one. Then it became a cattle feedlot next to the four barns with underground liquid manure storage, big holding ponds to store the winter storage of the liquid, and up the street, approximately within a half mile, they put a proposed swine operation in, 2,450 swine. Now, if you can imagine, this is all within three quarters of a mile, and two of them are at the same address directly across the street from me. What I want to describe is a community view of what it's like to live there. I will tell you now that I have moved out of my house a few months ago, and the reason for it was because my husband was just treated for radiation cancer. They tested my now 17-year-old, but he was 16, for cancer in the springtime. It's not normal for your child to go to school and then get off of the bus in front of your house and throw up because the air is that stench in it, to where when a child steps off the bus into the air that's supposed to be clean around his home, he actually throws up. I can tell you that I've had to call 911 because the fumes coming inside my house were so strong that I was dizzy inside my own house. I can tell you that when they had a mass mortality at the farm across the street in the middle of summer with 20,000 decomposing birds in the middle of July, it was not fun. If you can imagine that, it was flies literally in the house for months. And we heard a lot of talk about water quality and different things. We heard nothing about what's blowing out the fans at the neighbors. Okay? And I'm not going to get into that too much because we have someone here that can, but I will tell you that there are effects from all of this. I can tell you that I was taking my child to a doctor at 8 years old with tightness of the chest. I can tell you that after the 20,000 mortality, when my child would bathe in the bathtub after a rain event because their stormwater was washing off under the street into my backyard and settling, I was rushing my child to the hospital with palm-sized blisters all over his body. If you ever heard an 8-year-old cry because they don't want to go in the water because they're scared to take a bath, that should tell you what your home can become. The problem with these operations is that when something goes wrong, it goes really wrong. This is not like having, 20 cows on pasture. When you have problems, you're talking millions of gallons. We've had manure spilled all over both sides of the road, liquid, hundreds of feet. And what happened? The state agency didn't come out. No, they called the fire chief that was a friend of the operator. He came through sand on it before a rain event. This is what you're going to get. My suggestion to you, we at SRAP, Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, we are free to communities. I have lived this for 10 years. I know exactly what you're facing, and it's a fine balancing line. I will say one of the biggest impacts is the moral fabric of the community is totally destroyed because now there's a line in the sand, and it's one person's operation versus your home, your health, preserving your environment. How do you create that balancing line? How do you create tourism and what's at the beaches with farming to where it works? And the operations are getting so big that I can tell you it's not working. Our small family farmers are not able to make a living. They need to diversify. We need to create wealth in our communities. And we do this not by using an integrated system where literally a lot of the contract farmers become almost indentured servants to this industry. Right, like sharecropping. So I can tell you, I've dealt with this for a long time. We do a lot of things. I can teach communities how to do water testing. We have a program called Water Rangers, where we're not going to test and do results for any kind of mapping. We're going to test upstream and downstream of where the operation is, and if they're discharging, then it's going to be violated because someone has to step in and take the reins. I can tell you, Delaware now, 88% of the water there does not support swimming. 97% does not support aquatic life. We need to think, how many places do we have National Guard bringing water into because the public water is contaminated? This is a defining moment in your community because once the bell rings, you can't unring it. I suggest you get proactive and decide what you want your community to look like, because literally you are going to be the ones creating your community. How much is it worth to you? Is it worth it for you to be involved? I would absolutely say yes. It's beautiful here.
Thank you. Jillian Fry.
Thank you. I am on the faculty at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health on the Environmental Health Sciences Department, and I work at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and we study the food system through a public health lens. We take a very broad view. We look at worker justice, food insecurity, nutrition, on down the line. My focus has been on industrial food animal production and the impacts on public health, and also strengths and weaknesses of the regulatory approach in the U.S. So let me just give you a quick summary of some of the pollutants and health impacts that we are worried about in terms of large-scale poultry production. So when you have very high animal density, things that are coming off of the operation or leaching out where the manure is spread includes nutrients, pathogens that may or may not be resistant to antibiotics, drug residues that might have been that were used in animal production, and gases, including ammonia, volatile organic compounds. We're worried about particulate matter and heavy metals. I think everyone here is familiar with the large industrial fans that are forcefully pushing the air out of the large poultry operations. Of course, we also know that if these fans shut down, if the house loses power, there will be a buildup of gases that is coming off of the waste and from the birds, and they will die. So it's very important that all of that air is circulated out, and where is it going? It's going right into the community. If there are proper setbacks and proper zoning, hopefully there's not a direct health impact, but in a lot of cases, that's not true. So exposure routes that we're worried about. An exposure route is just how does this pollutant get to the human population? Research has documented flies as an exposure route with antibiotic-resistant bacteria on it. That research came out of the center where I work. Exposure routes also include workers, and, of course, workers are also a vulnerable population. But workers don't stay at the poultry operations. Of course, they then return to their communities after working, and they could have some pathogens and other items of concern on their person. We're also, research has documented pathogens coming off of the open air transport trucks. I mentioned the ventilation systems. And the health effects we're worried about include infectious diseases, respiratory illnesses, including asthma, bronchitis, and allergic reactions, thyroid problems, blue baby syndrome if infants are given contaminated water, neurological impairments, liver damage, cancer, gastrointestinal illness, and birth defects. I'm not saying that everyone who lives in an area where there's dense poultry operations experiences this gamut of health concerns. We don't have, the science is not at such a state where we have a count on, you know, if you have 10 operations here, then in this radius you're going to have this number of people have asthma. It's very site-specific, but what I will say is that we're very concerned about vulnerable populations, the very young, the very old, and individuals with pre-existing conditions. If you already have asthma and then you live near a very high-dense area for poultry production, that is a very significant health concern. Another thing that's important for me to communicate is that there are not robust monitoring systems in place to make sure that areas of dense animal production are not impacting public health. In all the years that I've studied these issues, that's something that has been really hard to get my head around and to communicate to people, because we live in the U.S., we have a robust regulatory system that hopefully, not 100%, but hopefully protects the environment. But it is, the regulations for these operations are not created, have not been created to protect public health. I greatly appreciate the talks that we had today, and I appreciate people coming to tell us what the regulatory efforts involve. But I want to connect some dots for you. There is no air monitoring. There is no water monitoring of people's private wells. I looked up the USGS data. Two-thirds of residents in these two counties, Northampton and Accomack, rely on private, unmonitored wells. There is no system in place to make sure that these poultry operations are not impacting your water. Some pilot studies have indicated that people don't generally test their water unless there's a glaring issue, and you could have high nutrients or high bacteria counts and your water is not brown, so we don't know. We know a lot more about the marine environment thanks to research like Mark's and other research. We know much less about the direct impacts to public health. That's partly due to a lack of resources for the research. And in our group, we're kind of like a scrappy group who, with whatever, you know, with the money that we have, we've done some really important research that has gotten arsenicals out of the poultry feed. It's kind of a harm reduction model. Get the arsenicals out, because that is ridiculous to have arsenic in the poultry waste that then is being spread in the environment. And research from our group and other groups has also led to poultry companies reducing their use of antibiotics that are important in human medicine. So that's a huge step forward, and I do appreciate that the companies are making that difference. But we do need to keep in mind that I've spoken to many impacted community members, actually did research about this, and also talked to regulators, and you may be already familiar with this, but impacted community members have almost like a deja vu experience with between the ones I talk to. You call an agency, that's not in my jurisdiction. Call this agency, you call that agency. Unless it fits into very specific regulations, such as the Clean Water Act, people don't have jurisdiction over this, and more times than not, they will not be able to help you in any substantive way. So, thank you.
Thanks, Leanne. Short, but to the point. Carol. Carol Morrison, who owns the Bird's Eye View Farm and used to be a contractor with Purdue.
Good evening. I was asked to come and first explain my experience as a contract farmer with a company here on the shore, and then tell you the good news. So I'll start with the contract growing, and I'm sure many of you, if you're not a farmer that's here, you have neighbors or friends or people who go to your church who do raise chickens. I don't know how much of their story that you all know. Many don't talk about it. There is fear for talking about it, and the fear is real. So I raised chickens under contract for 23 years. And, you know, what was once advertised as part-time work for full-time pay to entice farmers to build chicken houses is now considered supplemental income. So that tells you the difference in when you first started and how much things change, that your income goes down. Chicken companies today are offering cash incentives for people to build chicken houses. From what I have seen here on the peninsula, most operations are applying for at least 6 chicken house permits, if not more. I've seen as high as 15 and one at 21. So we're not talking about your farmer next door who's adding a couple of chicken houses into the family farm. We're talking about developments of chicken houses. These are not farms. These are people who are buying up prime farmland, coming in, building these chicken houses, and living elsewhere. So they're not really, you know, part of the community. They have no ties to the community. They just collect whatever it is they collect. I can't imagine how much they're collecting because money's just not there. The houses that are being built today will hold up to 60,000 chickens per house. When we built our two chicken houses back in 1987, they were state-of-the-art. Each house held 27,200 chickens. So we raised 54,400 chickens, five and a half times, so industry estimates number of flocks. I don't know why we just don't say five. But anyway, that many per year. Now we have 60,000 per house. If you take a person who wants to build six chicken houses, there's a cash incentive now being offered. Each house costs upwards of $380,000 apiece. So we're talking a lot of money, millions that are being invested. If a person builds six with the cash incentive that the companies are offering, a bonus of $67,000 and some odd goes for each house that you put up. Okay, if you do the math, the cash incentive will pay for the cost of one house off of the others that you're building. Okay, simply put, the farmer's paying for five, cash incentive company pays for one. Okay, as I said, they hold 60,000 chickens per house, and this cash incentive is the only way that a positive cash flow can be shown to a potential lender. Okay, it's where you're showing that money's coming in, and you're able to pay back this millions of dollar loan that you want just to build chicken houses. And I might add that a contract with a company is good for only one flock. It may be terminated at any time. Okay. If the lender is going to ask to see where you're going to get your positive cash flow, one thing that has always stymied me is that manure on the balance sheet is considered to be an asset to make your cash flow. And I'm sorry, but I need to take a moment here. If manure is an asset, why are we as taxpayers picking up the bill? Studies show that almost 70% of contract chicken farmers live below the poverty level from the income from chickens, which makes absolutely no sense. This was a study out of Alabama that took collected data all over the country from all kinds of farmers and developed the figures. Okay, as I've said, raising chickens is under contract. Contracts are designed by the company, are non-negotiable, and offered on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. After investing over $1 million, the grower has no choice but to sign the contract. Changes in contracts to shift more of the cost off of the company onto the grower. Constant demands for upgrades in housing and equipment, they're not unusual. So you go back to your lender and you borrow more money just to be paying to raise chickens to earn a below-poverty-level income. The threat of doing these things, instead of saying, nope, that's it, I'm not going to do it, comes from the fact that either you do what the company says or you can have your contract cut, and that's your choice. So as someone just said a while ago, sharecropping at its best. Okay. Through the contract, the pay to the grower is determined using a really complicated formula, and I'm not going to go into it because I never did understand it after 23 years. You know, we've had accountants take a look at these formulas, and they can't even figure them out. So I know I'm not going to figure them out. There's no checks and balances to ensure that the grower is fairly compensated, and there have been times that things have been proven that the pencil wasn't quite correct in payment. The grower invests in the land, buildings, and equipment and agrees to raise the company chickens to a marketable age, period. That is what the contract's all about. The company supplies the chicks, feed, medications, and other necessary items that they determine is needed to raise the flock of chickens. And each company has a program that the farmer is supposed to follow, and they're obligated to follow it. They have a person that comes out to the farm at least once a week to check on the chickens and the farmer to see, make sure they're doing the right thing. A report card type of form is left after the visit and tells the grower what to do. The grower makes no decisions regarding the growing of the flock of chickens, including feed formulas and medications. The cost and responsibility of manure disposal has been pushed off on the farmer, although the companies do own the chickens and everything that goes into it and comes out of it. So the responsibility for all of that goes on to a grower who is making a below-poverty level income from the chickens. So grower can't afford it. Guess who can? The taxpayers again. After all that good news, I'm going to tell you better news. It's all not as bleak as what it seems. After 23 years, I transitioned our farm over to a 500-head flock of laying hens on pasture for eggs. And from those 500 hens, I've proven through a grant through USDA Value-Added Producer Grant, doing a business plan, feasibility study, marketing analysis, you name it, I did it. The 500 hens earned me more money than the chicken houses ever did. That's only with 500 hens. So you figure I'm going from 54,400 chickens every 7 weeks to 500 hens out on pasture, rotating them around so that no certain area of the farm is saturated with manure. It allows the pastures to grow back up, rejuvenate, and we go round in circle and do the rotation. Environmental problems on my farm don't exist because I don't have way too many animals on the land. I have less animals on the land than what the land can support. So I'm quite proud of myself in a way for taking that issue off the board and out of my face, because I know now the land I'm leaving to my children isn't saturated with manure. The Eastern Shore used to be known for truck farming. There was, for those of you who have been here a very long time, you know, my age, and there's some old-timers, I mean really old-timers here that remember it. And, you know, there were incomes coming into the farm, being spent in the communities, and it was a thriving business. Very slowly, this was taken off the plate, and we became known as a concentrated area for raising chickens. These things are possible to do, but it takes a community to do it. Every farmer could go out there and start raising different things on their farm, but we do need the community members to support it. And in turn, those dollars that are earned on the farm are spent back in your community. We're talking about keeping dollars local. And this is what will rebuild communities, not, you know, shots of government money to try to make the issue better when it just keeps getting worse. So I consider that to be good news for the Eastern Shore, and I know there are more farmers out there than me. I just met one tonight who are doing different things on their land. And the opportunities are there, and I hope all of you would encourage your farmers to maybe try taking a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. So what I'd like to try to do here, since we only have about an hour left in this, and a lot of you have a lot to say, questions and thoughts for people on the panel, rather than me monopolizing these questions and answers, I want to come out there. And let me see how far this will go. Because the research I was doing before I got here, I think that, if I have it right, the last stat I saw on the Eastern Shore itself, on Delmarva completely, there were 569 million plus chickens that are raised every year. 24 million of those are in Accomack County. So, I mean, it's a growing industry, and I think what you described is where the industry is going, which are people who are not farmers actually buying up a lot of land to raise chickens, and that's becoming really a piece here. But rather than me go on, if you can get closer to me, I'll try to get this as far as I can to you. We need to get you here. I know what you're saying, but I need you to come here because we're taping this. All right, so we've got to get your voice.
No,
we still need to. We still need to.
Oh, you're taping it. That's right.
Humor him.
All right. What about the disposal of the mortality? How is that taking place?
At this moment, taxpayer dollars paid for composting bins, and in Maryland, I'm sure Virginia's probably going to have it. If they don't already, I know Delaware does. Freezers are going to be put on the farm. This is also your state government program where the mortality goes in there and then it is picked up by an unknown someone who will take and render the carcasses. My guess it'll go back into chicken feed.
Actually, this was for Roger Edgerton. You were the one who was talking about the nutrient management for the lands and the mortality disposal. So is there a government plan?
I'm Neil Zorodka, and I was talking. Yeah, as far as the permits required as far as mortality disposal, one of the key changes that was made in 2000 was the elimination of in-ground disposal. Disposal pits was something that was outlawed. So as far as the regulations right now, the regulations require such things as composting is the most common. There are a few small incinerators out there, but very few.
I'm talking specifically here on the shore.
Most of the mortalities are composted.
On the site?
Yes, ma'am.
And they're
yes,
monitored?
Yes, and it's part of what's inspected during inspections of the facility.
Why aren't there permits for the end user of the manure?
Those requirements, again, came about in 2010 where the end users have requirements that they must follow. But when we went through the regulatory process, the decision was made to not require permits for those folks. We can require a permit if someone's found to not be doing what they're supposed to do. But as long as they're following the regulation, they're not required to have a permit.
You got it? We can come back. Let me go right here.
Hello, thank you. A couple quick questions. I noticed on the map that Roger put up there showing the streams that were impaired or levels of impairment. It seemed like just about all the streams on the bay side of the Eastern Shore showed some level of impairment. And so my question is, when you're doing your permitting for soil applications of manure or other things, does that take into account what's currently on the ground right now or just what the loads from that would be? Does it look at what that individual permit is doing, or does it take a cumulative effect of looking at all the other permits that have already been issued? Thank you.
The map that I depicted that showed imperatives, you have to drill down to each impairment in each stream to see they are segmented, determine what the impairment is. So part of the stream could be impaired for bacterial contamination resulting and a resulting shellfish impairment, so it's listed as impaired. There may be additional impairments on that stream, so to drill back as to the cause and effect is not known at that time. That information is looking at what parameters impaired and what level it's at. I think you have some additional questions in terms of the permitting part.
Right, and I think your questions were about whether or not the location of a proposed facility to be permitted would be impacted by the presence of an impaired stream. And really, that is, it kind of goes back to what Roger was saying about the sources of impairments. And typically, you're going to have a lot of different sources of non-point source pollution. Typically, what we'll see is that that permitting is not going to be affected by the TMDL, mainly because one of the things that permits require are the implementation of best management practices. And that's one of the key pieces of implementation of a TMDL is making sure that proper agricultural best management practices are applied when you do have agriculture. So that's one of the things that the...
I'd like to get some feedback from... If Junior, you want to jump in, and Mark, maybe you want to jump in on this too.
Yes, the gentleman brings up a very key point, and I can speak a little bit more to the situation in Maryland because I live in Maryland and I've studied Maryland. I don't know the precise workings in Virginia, but in Maryland, we have a phosphorus management tool. It was recognized many years ago that we had way too much manure in the areas where there's high density. The science was known for a long time, and then the regulators kind of caught up to the science, partly because of the Chesapeake Bay watershed cleanup effort, the TMDL effort. And still, even with the phosphorus management tool and the legislators, the state legislators in Maryland saying, you know, we're not sure if we can, even though we know that's the science, it's rock solid science, you know, we're not sure that we can really ask farmers to meet it on the timeline that you want to because of the economic questions. So this tells us a couple of things. We know that the density is not compatible with a well-functioning environment, and they are still issuing permits for those areas. So then, like Carol said, the taxpayers are picking up maybe not 100% of the bill, but a significant portion of the bill to truck that manure somewhere else. So you're raising a very important point that the cumulative effects and the present animal density is not taken into account, and that's partly because if you have your NPDES permit and you're following best practices, the presumption is that you have zero discharge. But we just saw in this presentation that as poultry density goes up, you do have discharges. So there's a separation between regulations and reality, unfortunately.
And I just add, before Mark jumps in, I just add, I'm also from Maryland, and we cover this a lot. I'm going to come down there right after Mark speaks. And that Maryland's wrestling right now with what to do with the litter. One of the debates that's going to take place in the Maryland legislature is the Poultry Litter Management Act, about what happens to the litter, where it goes, all kinds of debates. You use it for fuel. Does it get trucked somewhere else? You use it for farmers out of state. I mean, there's a huge argument of who pays for it. Do the poultry companies pay for it? Should the state pay for it? I mean, that's the debate taking place right now about what to do with the phosphorus management tool, which leaves a lot more litter than before because they're managing it, and that leaves more piles of it. So that's happening here, and it's coming to a house near you.
And I just
it's coming to a skinnier point of land. Uh-huh. I see, we're the skinny end of the peninsula. So if you're running out of room at your end, we're not going to have room for your stuff, let alone our own.
And you already have your 24 million chickens. I'm going to come to that in 1 second. Let me go to Mark. I'm going to go here and come back here. Mark?
Yeah, well, I am not at all qualified to comment on the regulations and the siting, but I would just point out, you know, the to number one, not ignore nitrogen, because the farther you go down the peninsula, it, certainly in the Chesapeake Bay and on this side as well, nitrogen becomes more the pollutant of concern over phosphorus, although both are important. The thing that I would comment on that really struck me by the map of impairments, and again, it's hard to know what exactly the impairments were, but assuming many of them were water quality, you know, what stands out to me on that map is almost all of the red impairments are on the bayside, right? And whereas on the seaside here, it's much fewer. And what a lot of work has shown that for a long time, we always focus on the nutrients coming in from our watersheds. But what's always been underappreciated and what increasing evidence is showing is the importance of the water that's advecting in, that's moving into these tidal creeks and these estuaries and these coastal bays from offshore. It's a big volume of water, and it carries with it nutrients as well. Often as many as come from the land. It's just diluted. But I think what you're seeing in that map underscores a real advantage you have here on the seaside, a real attribute you have on the seaside in these systems is very clean water coming in from the Atlantic Ocean every day or two times a day on the tides, and you know, that which provides something of a natural filter and a buffer. Of course, we don't want to mess with the buffer, and I'm not suggesting that you do, but it's just it really stood out to me is an important attribute you have, and the further you go down the peninsula, the better it gets.
So, do you want to say something? Can you meet me halfway? I'm going to kill myself on this wire.
I just wanted to sort of share a different perspective, more of a historical one. But you know, the Eastern Shore of Virginia, as you know, is bounded by the Atlantic Ocean in the east and the Chesapeake Bay to the west. And sort of due to the favorable warm water temperatures in the early spring and late fall, these water bodies moderate the occurrence of frost. Both early spring and late fall seasons create a very long growing season. And these favorable climates during the growing season, in conjunction with the fertile soils, and these two counties are the top five agricultural producers in the state, producing a diversity of agricultural commodities. But if you look back in the history, during the early 1900s, these two counties, Eastern Shore, were the richest agriculture counties in the United States, and that was due to the abundance of food processing facilities located in both counties. And having over 20 food processing companies on the shore at that time, the local economy expanded, jobs were created in food processing, packaging, transportation, and construction. And the resulting economic activity supported by this expanded the hospital, the expansion of many of the towns and villages on the shore. You can go to all these, and they're about created in the same period of time because of the economy. But since this time, the food processing industry has largely left Accomack and Northampton counties, with the exception of the poultry food processors, who directly employ more than 4,000 of our residents with an annual payroll of $130 million. And they also offer sort of a multi-tiered management structure that allows employees to come in and start working at the ground level, but then also get raises and promotions and get benefits and retirement, which is not commonly available to most of the population here on the shore. And so I would sort of suggest, in addition, this industry supports more than 300 of our residents who grow poultry for the processors. In addition, approximately 740 residents are involved in the annual production of corn and small grains, with annual revenues in excess of $120 million per year. And the reason why this is significant is because these small grain farmers get a premium for the poultry feed that goes into the mills that feeds into the operation. Poultry also serves as a hedge against low grain prices. When grain prices drop, the cost of production of poultry increases the incomes. And the maintenance and expansion of the agricultural commodity is essential to the success of an economically viable agricultural industry. And probably to look at it in current situation, the U.S. Census reports that the poverty rate on the Eastern Shore of Virginia for the past 30 years has increased over each of the 10-year census periods to more than 20% of families and 20% of individuals. And over a five-year period since 2005, total employment in both counties has declined by over 16%. Incomes of those who have employment have dropped 5%, and the population of Northampton County has actually declined. The Eastern Shore of Virginia is an economic hole.
I'm
just trying to make a perspective. Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that getting out of this hole will require our politicians, business leaders, and our communities to make a long-term sustained effort focused on improving our workforce through education, increasing both public and private community investments, and the political will that supports businesses' expansion, because we cannot...
So what's the question?
The question is trying to share a perspective that maybe hasn't been presented today. So thank you very much.
So, that's good. So let's respond to that. The reality is that chickens, poultry, it's a huge industry, and it affects people's lives. So when we talk about what you do in terms of regulation for the land and the people and health, as well as what the alternatives might be, where do you begin the conversation? I mean, he's laid out some interesting facts. Who wants to jump in? I'm going to come back to the audience after we get this. So Carol, I guess you want to jump in as well.
I really appreciate that perspective, and it's also showing that as the poultry industry has taken hold of this area and really expanded, poverty has gone up, population has gone down. I'm not saying that it's a causative relationship. But I absolutely agree with the importance of infrastructure, and not just built infrastructure, but support from things like Extension and USDA and the state-based agricultural departments, research from your land-grant universities. All of that has shifted towards an industrialized, globalized food system. And then what we get in certain areas is when you're producing soy, corn, and poultry, and corn is a very leaky crop. When you fertilize corn, a lot of that runs right off into the environment. What you get is an environment that is completely out of balance. That's what we see here, and it's not healthy for the people either. And at the Center for a Livable Future, we would be so thrilled to work in collaboration with folks on Delmarva in doing research and getting partners on board to build up the regional food system again. Because if you think about the strength that Delmarva has is the proximity to the whole East Coast and the region here, you have very large population centers that you could, if you diversify your farms back to how it was, but in a new way, in a modern way, there are many large population centers who want to get responsibly, sustainably, justly produced food, in schools, hospitals, et cetera. So we would be so thrilled to be part of that effort, and I completely agree. Infrastructure and everything related to that is so important. And once you're down that hole, like somebody said, we're really down a hole, it's hard to get out of it, but it would be really important work.
So, very quickly, let's go to. Here's what I ask folks to do in the audience. If you want to, I think you're close. If you can come to me, that would be great. And I'll get to all of you. I've got some other voices here, and we'll get right back to you. You want to come down? Carol, you want to say something on this? And Maria?
I just wanted to say, the data and the figures that you've collected is wonderful. But it does show that in the early 1900s, when it was minus a poultry industry, the two counties were the richest in the country. Now they're getting close to probably being some of the poorest. So if this industry that is, putting so much money out there for the employees and into the community, it's hard for me to understand why the poverty level is so high in both counties. I just don't get it. The numbers don't add up. You did make the point of the early 1900s, and that's what I was speaking of. Agriculture was highly diversified at that time. Now it is not. There's only four things that go round on this peninsula. It's corn, soybean, wheat, and chickens. Tomatoes, I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. Tomatoes are a big thing in the two Virginia counties, not so much up our way, but some. And that's all we have. If we support and encourage through all of the programs right now that subsidize the food industry, and we level the playing field for farmers who want to be independent and do different things, and level out the divvying of money to support farming, then we'll have a level playing field, and I think you'll see a huge change in food production.
I mean, I'm going to come back to the panel here, but let me go here first. Then come back. Hold on.
Okay. there was a good segue about the history of agriculture in the county. The poultry industry of today is not anywhere near equivalent to any of the agricultural industries that were here formerly. It is about the business model. And formerly, the money stayed here. They were local producers, local processors. Now the money leaves the shore. It goes to Perdue and Tyson. Yeah. They are the oligarchs in charge of it. The money goes out. The chickens go out to Qatar, to Asia. The pollution stays here. So let's talk about the subsidy that the residents of the Eastern Shore pay to Perdue and Tyson, okay? And this has got to stop. Each time there is a fire, a spill, another payment is made to the industry from the citizens of the Eastern Shore. Each day there is air pollution and health effects in the environment, in our environment, we pay. We are paying. Disease outbreaks like Fisteria and SARS, which will be, they're inevitable. It's a probabilistic thing. Things break. Fans break. Trucks roll over. Okay? Fires start. There are fires every year on the shore from the chicken waste. Okay? Each time as that is, we pay. We pay from the poisoned shellfish. We pay from our waters that are eutrophied by the phosphorus and the nitrogen and algae blooms. All these costs are not figured in to the profits and loss of Tyson and Perdue, nor are they figured into the cost of their sharecroppers. Okay? But they are paid by us. The industry grows. As the industry grows, the subsidy grows. Okay? At some point, you have shown that the pollution gets so big, it exponentially increases. It reaches a tipping point where there are no more shellfish. They're inedible. Okay? And I'm going to get to the question here.
Because there are a lot of people here all the time.
Okay? We're at the tipping point, and the question is, how many chicken houses can we support before we get to the chicken point, tipping point? Our supervisors are going to spit in the air and come up with some regulations that allow thousands of chicken houses in Accomack County. When I say that, there are several hundred now, okay? Anything they say, any setbacks and stuff, are going to eventually allow a build-out of thousands of chicken houses, okay?
Okay.
Who is going to do the research to find out how many chicken houses we can support before the tipping point comes?
Let me go back here.
Okay.
So
I hear nobody saying that.
1 second. All right. So what do we know about the science? About numbers of chicken houses that a community like this, other communities can support.
One of the uses of these types of models that I presented, and we can certainly run those scenarios. The problem is that there are a number of uncertainties, which I tried to allude to. We run these simulations. There's a number of parameters. Each of those parameters we don't know very well. There are certain things about the chickens that give us a special headaches, things like, the waste is kept on these pads. How much really leaches? It's very hard to know that. How much volatilizes? It's very hard to know that. How much is exported? Where does it go? How much is imported? Where does it go? So there's a lot of uncertainty there, but that is what these models are useful for. Yeah, well, and there may be no answer. That's right. And so, we can push in the numbers and hit run. And in fact, I do that all the time. But
support 10 times more chicken houses without screwing up the environment and our public health. That is the question.
He's saying that the science is not there to know the answer to that question.
That's a wrong answer because the science is there. For every point you have, there's a probability of what to happen.
All right, but wait, just a second. Just a second. Sir. What they're saying is, I understand what you're saying, but the science has not been there to determine that number exactly is what he's saying.
But you don't need it exactly.
Okay, that's fine. Let's go over here. I got you. It's out.
I'm from Maryland, and I was in an agricultural area, and manure management was a big thing. And there had to be a minimum of 5 acres per horse. Mm-hmm. Is there a minimum acreage per bird?
No.
I can answer that. And it's based on the nutrient management plan. So in other words, and that's based on the content of the manure after it's removed from the house, and not as excreted as you're talking about. There are differences as excreted versus after storage. But that's essentially what happens is that depending on the crop, depending on the productivity of the soil and the ability of that crop to take up the nitrogen and the phosphorus, depending on the soil phosphorus saturation level, that all will change that number. But yes, there's a number that's associated with the number of chickens, but it depends on soil types and crops.
If X is the manure per bird times the number of birds, then what's the amount of land that is needed to support the manure that's coming off of those birds?
It depends on the type of soil, the
depends on
crop.
The saturation of the soil that's been had manure on it earlier.
No, not necessarily. That's the soil phosphorus saturation, whether
okay.
it comes from previous
commercial
applications.
So if someone
applications
is going
or not.
To want to dispose of or fertilize their soil and they don't have a permit and they don't care, then there's no regulation that says, well, your soil is saturated. You can't put this on there.
Right.
If they're using poultry manure, there is a regulation that...
But there's no permit for the end user that I understand. Am I wrong? That there's no permit for the end user to use the manure on their land?
That's correct, but it's still a requirement of law.
What law? What law? Maybe I didn't speak loud enough.
It's state water control law implemented through the regulations of DEQ. There are a number of requirements that you and I both have every day that are required that we do that we don't have a permit to do. So there are certain things that law requires that if there's noncompliance, there are consequences. But
okay.
we don't. There's not necessarily a permit issued for
that. Who is monitoring that end user?
We currently do that on a complaint basis
for
end
basis.
Users.
Okay.
Yes. All right. So, Maria, let me let you say something, and Jill, we'll come to this gentleman right here. Maria?
Yeah, I want to address that a little bit because I tell you what, this is, I'm glad you brought that up. This is one of my strong problems with this is that when you go to do a nutrient management plan, although someone has to account for where it's going to end up, that plan does not have to be public. If it's a broker involved and they're taking it out of state or to another farm where it has an end use, that plan is not publicly available to say this operator is taking it to that farm, right?
In Virginia, they are. All nutrient management plans in Virginia are public information.
But the receiving end of the plan, how would somebody access that because it's not a permit? So how would they access that if it's – where would you access that? If I want to see where someone is a receiving end, where would I come to your office?
If DEQ were inspecting that to make sure that they were compliant and we were to have that record in our office, then it would be public information. If it's not in our office, it's not public information. So you'd be correct. If it's someone that has a plan as an end user.
So in other words, our tax dollars – okay, and I want everybody to get this because I want you to call your legislators. Our tax dollars are paying to truck manure back and forth between states, between farms, and this is subsidized with public money, and guess what? Nobody knows where it's going. And I can tell you this because I looked at a specific application in York County for a Hillendale operation. Okay, we're talking 3 million birds. This is not. I'm sorry. No. In Pennsylvania, this was. I was looking at. I look at nutrient management plans in various states where I am. But this is just an example. Okay, the manure they had on the technical comments need nutrient balance sheets. Then it's crossed out and it says out of state. So in other words, the manure from 3 million birds is going into Maryland, but guess what? I called Maryland. Nobody keeps track of what's coming in. This is a big game. There is no accountability at all. So you should be aware of that, and you should be aware that your tax dollars are supporting this, And I'll tell you, farmers who are contracted, some states require them to be in order to get money for conservation loans. So the whole program is set up and designed to push farmers into this type of farming. And like you say, it benefits the stockholders, you know, not the communities. Individual farms, I know farmers who want to farm right, but they have to take their animals two states away because there is no longer an independent processing plant. The whole system we need to put together, like Jillian said, it's not, you know, an easy thing to do anymore because it is guided in this direction. Jillian? Of industrialization.
And I mean, there are no independent processing plants in the Eastern Shore. If you have an animal, you got to take it somewhere else.
Right.
Pennsylvania is probably the closest place you can go.
Yep.
Jillian, and then we'll go right here.
Delaware has a USDA inspected.
If I could just try to add a little bit of clarification in terms of the nutrient management plans. So when a farm creates a nutrient management plan, they will say how many of what animal they have and what crops they're going to grow and the acreage. And then, depending on the state, there will be soil samples that tell you the level, you know, the levels and the types of soil that you have and the appropriate amount of the manure that you can apply there. The problem is the nutrient management plan the way that they operate, Maryland and Virginia have had nutrient management plans for a long time, but we still have the issues that we have. It's on paper. It's record based, and then you have some inspections. I mean, think about how geographically dispersed our agricultural system is. You know, you can't check all the time, and like one of the speakers said, when you have an end user, so I think when they refer to end user, they're talking about someone who's importing manure onto their farm. They're not talking about all farmers applying manure as the end user. It's just end users that are taking in manure from another farm. And he referred to it as complaint-based. So we don't really know how well the manure levels are being applied according to nutrient management plans. I mean, either the nutrient management plants aren't adequately protecting the environment from over application, or their people are not following their plans. Because if you look at the nutrient loads in our watershed, the U.S. Geological Survey will come out every so often with a report on Delmarva and say some of the highest levels of nutrient pollution and also pesticide residues in this watershed. And that's where we're at. We've had nutrient management plans in place for many years.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'll probably get shot. I'm a commercial poultry grower up in Accomack County. I'd like to thank DEQ for coming here. And, Steve, I was going to say this before I saw you were here. I've had a great relationship with DEQ. I get inspected every year by Steve Thomas there or one of his cohorts, and I've always gotten along well with them. So I really appreciate y'all's interest in this. Steve, help me out on this. We do know where our manure goes. An end user has to put down the farm, the creek number, the nearest zip code, the nearest town, nearest body of water, and I believe end users now have to put down track numbers. Is that correct?
Not track numbers, but location.
So we, at least within Virginia, we do know where, within a very small distance, where the manure is going. Ms. Morrison, I'm sorry that you had such a terrible experience with Purdue. I also raised for Purdue. I've done very well. I've been doing it for just over 24 years now. I have four employees, all who are above the poverty level, and I'm way above the poverty level. So I don't know what
is
the experience.
Is your farm diversified or just
chickens? I am 100% chickens. Everything I've got is staked on chicken and chicken alone, and I had no incentives whatsoever to help me build my houses. And I do great, and I'd build more today even without the incentives if I were thusly inclined. I'm not. I listen to you. Listen to me.
God bless you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. I apologize for interrupting you. So it's not all the, you know, and some of the stuff that you presented I believe is outdated. So it's not all gloom and doom. Some of us do quite well. Thank you.
And I think that the complexity of what this gentleman just raised is real.
Yeah.
I mean, the part of the problem is in the process of trying to figure out what to do with all the places that we live and what we want is the danger is, I think, sometimes is pushing us to the point where farmers who grow the chickens are demonized, and that's not the answer either, because they're making a living, and this is the agricultural system they're stuck with. And the question is, if you want a new agricultural system, none of us will really figure out how to get there. I mean, that's part of the issue. But let me go with Carol, then I'll go right to you.
Okay.
I'll let her respond, and then I'll come right to you.
I totally agree about the farmer being demonized, and I think I tried to point that out in my presentation. The gentleman who just spoke, I'm very familiar with. He seems to show up wherever I show up in Virginia.
If you also go out.
Whatever. As I said, God bless you.
Sir?
Okay, my first, this is the first comment, it's just a comment rather than a question, is, you know, from what I'm hearing about chicken manure, chicken waste coming off of these farms, I mean, it sounds to me like it should be considered a hazardous material when it's being transported. Is that the case? I mean,
No.
All right. But it certainly sounds like it. Okay. That's an editorial. Second question is, it sounds like no matter where we are, and the gentleman from the DQ talked about setbacks. I don't know what those values are. But it sounds like up to this point, setbacks at best are just an absolute guess as to what they should be. I mean, based on your models, Mr. Rush and Ms. Fine, if I were to say to you what needs to be done to be able to develop models that would give you a scientific basis to say these are safe setbacks from streams or the bayside or the ocean side or homes, okay, from an air perspective, what data don't you have, and why don't you have it, and how could you get it?
Interesting questions. Where do we go first? The state, and then we can come over to Mark.
I was just going to make a real quick comment in that the setbacks from water bodies and are backed by research regarding vegetated setbacks versus non-vegetated setbacks and so forth. That's why in Virginia, if there's a vegetative setback, then it's 35 feet from a stream for land application. If it's non-vegetated, it's 100 feet. But there's a lot of research about how much nutrient reduction occurs in overland flow and in subsurface flow as far as distance from streams.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just agree that there is an awful lot of information, and there are models out there, watershed models out there that would address those sorts of questions. Mine is not one of them. Mine is a fairly simplified, very large area model that doesn't consider real small spatial differences in terms of buffer widths and that sort of thing. So it's not the kind of thing mine would address, but models do exist that do have that level of spatial resolution. My issue with that is that the finer resolved you go, and the more complex you make them, you require a lot more data to build them, and you get a lot more uncertainty in them. So there's a trade-off there. I tend to go to the other end of the spectrum.
I'm sorry, just to follow up. So where would a municipality, a board of supervisors, who are trying to set fair to both the farmer and to the people who live there, where do they go to figure out what is a safe, environmentally safe setback?
Jillian, why don't we go to Jillian and then...
Yeah, that's a very good question. And when you go from environmental impacts to health impacts, it gets a lot more complicated. We are looking into this issue at our center, but we don't have the information that's necessary. It depends on the species. It depends on weather patterns. It depends whether there's vulnerable populations living nearby. So we are frustrated by the same gaps in the science. There's certainly some science, where you can support a decision just based on the science that we have. We're also looking into that. But in terms of a definitive answer, based on specific situations, we're a bit ways from that in terms of a public health perspective.
So let me just say that the folks in line, I'm going to get to everybody's comment here. I think, ma'am, you'll be the last comment for the evening just because we only have like 20 minutes left given when we started. But, sir, why don't you go ahead?
Got a quick general observation related to some extent to what Tony Picardi said. The money that's available to move manure from our area really resides with the Tyson and Purdue and the other integrators at this point. Most of the growers do not have the money, and in fact, one indication of this is the fact that these companies are able to export chicken to Russia, Ukraine, Mexico, all over the world. As a previous commenter said, they get the chicken, they get the cheap chicken, the companies get the profits, we're left with the manure and the other environmental problems. It's my understanding, and Mark, you might be able to address this, or perhaps Jillian, that legislation has been introduced in Maryland to put some of the costs of transporting this manure to places that are not surrounded by water, as we are, on the integrators. Do you know if anything about that legislation, or whether it's possibly in the cards for Virginia?
It's called the Poultry Litter Management Act, the one that's being introduced into the Maryland State Legislature. And that act, and Julian, please jump in here.
I'm not aware of one.
Well, that act would say that the right now the state of Maryland thing pays like $5 million for transport. They're saying all that money plus the money that Purdue or Tyson puts in should be on the integrators, not on the farmers and not on the state. So that's part of the legislation going. And also that the litter should not go to sensitive areas in other states, not just to dump it, let's say, out of Pennsylvania or New Jersey and some other sensitive area, or down here in Virginia, that it would have to be. And what happens a little next is part of the argument. Some people think it should end up being that we should be building plants that turn litter into energy. That's one of the arguments being made. And others into pellets so they can be farmed, used for farmers around the country. So the big question is, what do you do with all the litter once you move it? And I think that's an answer. That's a question that hasn't been answered, but that act is now, will be in front of the Maryland State Legislature to debate in this session. I don't think there's not an act like that in Virginia at the moment, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, too, that the program in Virginia to subsidize movement of poultry litter is confined to movement of poultry litter in select counties in the Shenandoah Valley, where poultry production is dense, move outside of a certain area. So, to my knowledge, there's no public money being used to move poultry manure on the Eastern Shore.
Yeah. Did you want to add to that, Jillian, at all before we move to
the next? In Virginia. I can only speak to Virginia.
Yeah.
Ma'am?
So, I didn't hear any discussion on the amount of groundwater or groundwater usage by poultry industry. Should we have any concern about that and our aquifers in the Eastern Shore of Virginia?
That's a good question. Who wants to grab that one? Any aquifer thinkers here?
I mean, I'm told the answer is yes, but I don't know any more than that.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at what happened in California with agriculture and aquifers, I mean, it's a really serious question to ask.
The only water we have here is rainwater that falls. We have no supply from the mainland or north. That's from Painter south to the tip.
From the farm aspect, of course, the animals drink a lot of water. With the new housing that is totally enclosed, the only way to cool the chickens during the summertime when temperatures reach a certain degree is through what they call foggers. It's a misting system that runs in conjunction with the fans. So, of course, if you're building more chicken houses, you're using more water. That isn't scientific based, it's just common sense.
And I apologize, I don't have the numbers with me because that's not my program, but in Virginia we do have water withdrawal reporting requirements for facilities that withdraw a certain amount of water, and that can be estimated based on the number of birds you have in a house, so we relatively know. So we'll go to growers who have a certain number of birds and make sure that they're reporting water usage.
Is that publicly available?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's come up here, Kathy. Come right to you.
If I could just clarify on this comment.
Kathy Phillips.
Yes, thank you. Up in Maryland, we also have Maryland Department of the Environment does require water withdrawal permits for every CAFO that is built. And one of the biggest problems with that is the modeling will be looked at just for that one particular CAFO. How much water will it need to withdraw per year? And the permit is issued based on a maximum number of gallons that that CAFO can withdraw without impacting the aquifer. The permit does not look cumulatively how many other CAFOs are within a certain radius of this one. Is the next one 10 miles away? Is it 1 mile away? Is it 600 feet away? And this has been one of our concerns up in Maryland and with Astead Coastal Trust as we look at these water withdrawal permits, is that the state, in all of its permitting, the CAFO general permit, the nutrient management plan, well, not the nutrient management plan so much, but definitely the water withdrawal permits, that cumulatively those impacts are not considered. And I'm sure it's probably the same way in Virginia, just as the gentleman said. You know, they look permit by permit, how many gallons per day, and then it's issued.
Thanks, Kathy.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to speak. Not so much a question, but a general comment. It's been a great forum, but there's one component missing of this whole thing. Where's the representatives from Tyson and Purdue? They should be here. This is about them. Were they afraid to come? Or maybe they've been lynched. But they need to be a voice to tell what they're doing about the problem, what the perspective is, and how they can help fix the problem. If they're not in the equation, they're part of the problem.
I do know that neither Mr. Tyson nor Mr. Purdue will ever come and address any of you. Normally, the program is that they go through the trade association in any given state or area. Here, it's Delmarva Poultry Industry Incorporated, which is DPI. But don't look for Mr. Purdue nor Mr. Tyson to come and talk to you.
I don't particularly care about them, but a representative would have been nice.
I agree.
They're creating the problem. They're part of the problem. They should be here to address it.
September 19th, we had an earlier Waterkeeper Chase right over there sponsored, and we did have some representatives from the industry there. I don't even know if they were invited, so I don't want to be unfair to them in terms of this particular forum. But I think the thought was we had one forum where they were invited, and I think Jay gave them a pretty good chance to try and talk about that. They did talk about things like water pooling, for example, and I know their argument was it doesn't take a lot of water to raise chickens. Don't know where we could evaluate that one way or the other. But in terms of today's forum, they're only not here because we have a full forum. It would be nice, and I agree, and maybe in the future we'll be able to pull some of them in.
That's a very strong point.
May I ask everybody out here an easy question?
Go right ahead.
How many of you eat chicken? Raise your hand. Okay, I think there's a demand in our society for good, diversified, fresh, preferably local food. Our chicken is probably local. But my question is, we've been all about problems tonight and all the issues. We need some solutions. I believe that small diversified farms, yeah, where we came from in the early 1900s, is a good way to go for the shore. So my question to you all, and I know that this probably isn't exactly what you're here for, but what would you tell our boards of supervisors that they should, how should they proceed to get us back to where we were in the early 1900s? Because I think that's a really, really up-and-coming industry right now, is small diversified farms producing quality vegetables, quality meat, quality food. How do they get there? They need to know that.
From a farmer perspective,
good question.
I would say that if you're raising animals for food, that there are a limited number of animals that the land can support, and that is all that is allowed.
But so, I mean,
Animal units are what measure everything. You know, how much can the land support as far as animal units go?
So I think you raise a really important question, and I would like to kind of push our panel to think about this for a moment. I mean, if the reality is that most of us, when we buy a chicken, don't want to spend $6 a pound for a chicken. We just don't. And you go to a farmer's market, you buy a free-range chicken, it costs you a lot of money. So, we just heard earlier, the gentleman over here talk about, and one of the stats he gave, the growth of poverty, incomes lowering on the shore. People don't want to have to buy food that costs a quarter of their family budget. So that's a really important question. And most people in this room raise their hand when they said, do you eat chicken?
As far as that goes, as far as what you just said, Mark, industrial production is held up and supported by subsidies. Taxpayers don't realize it, but, you know, how cheap do you think your chicken is? You're paying in a whole lot of different ways that you don't even know. If you had to pay the true cost, it would be that $6 a pound. So let's level out some of these giveaways to the industrial model and give it to the smaller model and see how it works. My chicken wouldn't be $6 a pound.
Okay. Maria, you were going to say what?
Yeah, and I agree with that. That's externalizing their costs, and that's how come they're able to thrive. But I would encourage you to go to your school district. Start small. Go there. And I'll tell you what, I've seen many communities that are starting to do programs like where one day a week they will have local food. And I'll tell you what, I've seen some very successful programs where they actually have the children that are out there learning to do, to prepare the food and to grow the food. It becomes like a school project. I just read last week there is a school district in California. They are 100% organic. They're learning better. I mean, the studies prove it. So it's a matter of us pushing this, you know, going to your supervisors, get creative and saying, how about, you know, you give us an area where we can have, you know, some type of a farmer's market in there. They have money that they use, you know, that they can incentivize to start small and do. But it's basically, you're right, it's the community demanding it and coming together and creative out-of-the-box ideas. New York does a wonderful program with their milk. Their local farms, they pick it all up from their local farms for the school system. It can be done, but it's not easy. It takes a coordinated effort. Co-ops, where you have, we have it in Lancaster, and I believe they're in, like, I think it's five different states now, where they come, pick it up, and they take, and so you need a network of people to work on it, but it is doable.
Mark, I would just say, I addressed this a little bit earlier, but it needs to be multi-pronged. There's many, many aspects of our regulations and things that are related that support this form of farming and food production, and that has built up over many, many years. And it has to do with many, many different agencies and non-governmental agencies in terms of procurement, hospitals, like Maria was saying, schools, restaurants, you know, there can be studies done that model this is how much farmland you have, this is what would be grown on that type of soil and in that climate area, you know, in those conditions. You can do modeling and figure out what it would be. So there's very scientific ways to go about it and to see how products grown on the Eastern Shore could be sold locally here and also regionally. And people are really demanding that right now. There's a huge opportunity there to try, you know, not that it would be a complete shift and not that it would be quick, but to start bringing up and supporting that type of agriculture, because like Carol's saying, there are lots of ways that we support the current model. It's happened over many years, and we should support the other forms and not look at it as a handout because we're already doing it for the other form of food production.
I have a question to Carol. Carol, an argument was that the poultry growing industry is a big job creator. How many people did you employ in your six chicken farms without counting family members?
None.
So this argument is zero.
Zero.
Thank you.
Well, to be fair, I mean, the surrounding chicken industry does provide a lot of jobs. As we said, 4,000 in the plants and other places. So that just to be that. Who's here? Jeb. And then we should get some closing thoughts here from the panel about where we think Accomack and Northampton are going and where they can go.
Thanks. All right. My name's Jay Ford. I'm with Virginia Eastern Shorekeeper. We're just coming down from the Accomack Board of Supervisors meeting, and so we wanted to give everyone kind of an update on what's going on. Accomack, on February 3rd, will be voting for their new poultry ordinance. As it's currently constituted, it is the recommendations from the poultry industry. That's all. It's taken directly from their Good Neighbor handbook. There's been a lot of public comment so far. There absolutely needs to be more. This is, for those of you in Accomack, for those of you that understand the economy there, Steve obviously does. I think everyone's saying the right thing, that there needs to be a transition, and we need to see a transition in Accomack, but part of that means that right now the industry doesn't get to write their regulations because we will see such an industrial growth that it will be impossible for us to pull back from it. So we're not asking them for a complete stop. What we're asking them for is to come up with a sustainable model for allowing these things to be placed away from schools, away from elderly homes, in hospitals, away from population centers, in agricultural zones where they belong. And I think that the board is open to it. For those of you that live in Northampton, I encourage you to come talk as well. I recall when Accomack supervisor came down to Northampton to talk to you folks about the Bay Protection Act, and that was important and it was powerful. And it's because here we are sharing our resources between the two counties. So if Northampton has a full stop and Accomack goes full steam ahead, you're still going to get the manure, you're still going to get the runoff, and you may not have to live next to it, but you're still going to have to live with the consequences. So please, everybody, February 3rd, put it on your calendar now, and at 6 o'clock at Metompkin Elementary, come up and let them know, no matter what county you're in, that you want to see a sustainable plan put in place, and that for certain setbacks should be restrictive around our vulnerable populations in particular, and around some of our vulnerable industries, like creeks that feed into our hatcheries for aquaculture. The other thing I will say, since it was brought up, the withdrawal issue, that was something that our groundwater committee was partnering with the Accomack Northampton Planning District Commission to work on. They've since pulled the plug on that, so we were going to have a workshop on this, and now we're not going to. So we don't know what those withdrawal consequences are going to be, and unfortunately we no longer have a plan to get a comprehensive study done on that topic. And so it's something that we're talking to the state about. I know Kathy raised the point that these are figures that should be aggregated. So should manure loads. And so in the coming months, we were talking about this as kind of a part two. The part three of this, folks, is we're going to start talking about how we as a community go to our state and federal officials and ask them that if they're going to go sell our products in Cuba and Qatar and Oman and help us grow our poultry industry, that we need to see concurrent regulations at the same time. That you can't grow one part of this without properly regulating it at the same time. And so I hope that you guys will all continue to participate in this process.
Thank you. And chairman is here. Sir?
I'm Spencer Murray. I'm chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Northampton County. And these seats are hard and the hour is late. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what we're doing in Northampton. This is an emotionally charged issue, and it just seems to me that the technology with respect to the integrators has outstripped far the front end and the back end of this whole process. Zoning, and we don't all agree on it, zoning is the only tool we have to control what we want in our community. We've done that for years. We had an election on November 3rd of last year. The previous board passed in a lame duck session a zoning ordinance that we are now in the process of repealing. We are going back to the 2009 zoning. We are adding setbacks for poultry, well, for CAFOs and AFOs, that will make it such that we will protect our tidal streams, we will have clean waters, we will not ruin our agriculture, and we will get this done hopefully in the next couple of months. And I just say to those people who, our friends in Accomack, I hope you will do the same kinds of thinking. As somebody said, this is a bell we cannot unring. Yeah. The poultry situation reminds me of an old Chinese saying. It says something. It goes something like, when a man with money meets a man with experience, the man with experience goes away with more money, and the man with money goes away with more experience.
Right.
We don't need the experience of massive industrial CAFOs.
Thank you. Thank you. So, as we conclude the evening, I don't know if our conveners want to say something as we conclude this. All right, I just want to thank you all for coming out. I want to thank the panel for taking their time and coming from several different states. And thank you all for coming out tonight.